get the rest of our trustees to find their way back. Checking the markets, Tim? Is that what you're doing?
Me?
Yeah. Had some domestic issues to discuss.
Okay, well, welcome back. Tom Farrell is going to give us a presentation on the University of Illinois Foundation, and acknowledge next week you're going to have your whole foundation board here in town.
That's right.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. I have one slide. Could someone please put that? Okay, good. So Chairman Kennedy and the board asked me to give a brief update on university fundraising progress. We provided this material previously. I'll just explain the slide quickly. We basically track two major categories of fundraising progress. One is new business or new commitments, and the other is cash in the door. We look at it from a university point of view and then from a campus point of view. We, of course, also look at it from a unit point of view within campus. We look at it by source. We look at it by level, we look at it by gift type, et cetera. We look at it by purpose or designation. But I'm gonna try to keep it very brief and just give you a quick update. With 32 days left in the fiscal year, we've updated these figures, which are the April 30th figures. New business has improved to $329.9 million, which is 17.2 million greater than our three-year average of 281. Cash is up to 208.9 million, which is now an increase of 10.1%. And the campus trends remain the same as you see on the slide. Urbana is up, Chicago and Springfield are down versus last year. Urbana is up or flat in all gift categories, except the 100K through $1 million category, where they're down 15 donors off their three-year average of 161 donors at that level of 100,000 to 1 million. The reason I mention that is that Urbana did receive, of course, the $100 million Granger gift this year, which we're all grateful for, but does push their numbers up significantly, which is a good thing. But at the same time, they have seen improvement in other categories as well, so it's not a completely skewing gift. Chicago is down, largely, as I look at the data, as a result of a smaller number of $5 million gift commitments. They're also coming off very strong years in fiscal year 12 and fiscal year 11. But if you look at their $5 million gift commitments this fiscal year to date, with the fiscal year not being complete, they're at $18.4 million versus their $28.3 million average over the last 3 years. And they also did $49 million in very large gifts last year. They do have some very large gifts in the pipeline. Paul and I were just talking about this, as we've been talking about. So it's quite likely that they could come in with a very significant year this fiscal year. It's too early to say. They've also done well at the $1 million gift level, which is important. They're at $21 million versus $16 million over their average. So they're showing some strength, but the numbers aren't over yet. Springfield is up in total gifts, including at the major gift level, but some of those gifts are smaller than we typically receive at Springfield. And again, I think it's important to note that from a Springfield perspective, there are some major solicitations scheduled, particularly around the Student Center project. So again, I think that Chancellor Cook would tell us that This fiscal year is not done yet, so we'll see where these numbers actually end up. And then from a cash perspective, the overall university number is being driven, as I think it probably should be, by the $1 million-plus gift category. Right now, we're at $86.7 million in large gift activity versus the three-year average of $61.7 million. This is cash payments, which is a 40% increase in that top-of-the-pyramid type activity. I will end by just saying that another thing that the board and Chairman Kennedy has asked us to do is to focus more on metrics and to establish a clearer dashboard to share with the board on an ongoing basis, and we're working on that. The metrics that we are looking at pretty aggressively are classic metrics like visits, solicitations, contacts, and the other thing we really need to look at is our pipeline management activity, because the results that we see in this data are directly related to what we have in the pipeline. So we're trying to work very aggressively with the campuses, the leadership, the units, the foundation staff, the foundation board, to put in place a planning process, metrics-based approach, and a very aggressive pipeline management process to make sure that we're doing everything we can do to generate greater levels of philanthropy. And I would just end by saying we could have a very, very good year, particularly on the new business side this year. It could be our best year ever, which would make sense given the strength of the activity we're seeing at the top of the pyramid and the largesse of the Granger Foundation and other large gifts. So it should be a good year, particularly from new business. It will be a better year on the cash side because of some large cash payments. But again, we're looking to increase both new business and cash pretty aggressively over the next few years. And I look forward to talking to the board more about that as we finish up our comprehensive strategic planning exercise, the roadmap, over the next couple of months.
Very good. Questions for Tom? I just might mention next Wednesday night, when your foundation's here, the board has been invited to come to a reception that you're having.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many of you are planning on coming, but I think it would be a great opportunity to be able to meet some of the folks who serve on the foundation board. We're blessed to have some really powerful people on the board that love the university and all campuses. So we look forward to that opportunity.
Yes.
I just have a question. Could you just generally describe the process by which each of the university units raise money and what the role of the foundation is in that process?
Well, each campus follows the same approach to raising money, which is to look at different segments and populations and to pursue those populations. So looking at large gifts, $1 million and above, looking at gifts at the major gift level, which would be $100,000, looking at annual gifts, which would be $1 to $25,000. So looking at all the different gift segments, using all the different methodologies to connect with those entities, whether it be direct mail, telemarketing, face-to-face activity, staff outreach, volunteer, peer-to-peer activity, et cetera, and trying to present their case for support, solicit those entities, and close those commitments. The role of the foundation has different components, but one of the things we're trying to talk about is the fact that the overall development operation at the university is one development operation that's heavily matrixed, that all so that all campuses relate to the foundation at some level, and the foundation and the campuses relate together because we have a shared constituency, a shared community ultimately, but that one place where the foundation is traditionally viewed as being a key component of the overall process is in the services area, so gift processing, research, stewardship, gift planning, event activity, those types of things are conducted as a central function for the overall university and campus environment.
In terms of the funds that you receive, are most of them restricted?
Yes, most of our funds are restricted, probably 75% either to purpose or type, so restricted to endowment, or restricted to a specific purpose at a college or a unit or a campus. And we raise around, probably around $40 million in unrestricted type dollars. But remember, one thing I didn't note is we have 130,000 gifts per year already. So from 70,000 donors, so it's a large enterprise.
Thank you.
Further questions? All right, very good. Tom,
thank you.
Thank you very
much.
All right, the rest of the meeting is devoted to some brief reports by several different presenters, and President Easter, I think we'll start with you.
I have nothing further to add.
That was a quick report. At this time, we'll deal with old business. Is there any old business to be brought forward to the Board of Trustees today? Seeing none, is there any new business to be brought forward to the Board today? Seeing none, I will now invite Professor Phil
Patson
to update us on the activities of the Chicago Senate for the past year. Welcome.
Thank you. I don't have any data to show you, so I don't have a slide. I'll just talk to you for 2 minutes, if that's okay. Each year, the Senates give a report on the activities of the last year, and since we're in Chicago, this is a UIC Senate report to you. You should have a report in your package that I sent to you. Hopefully you got that and have a chance to look at it and can see the activities of the Senate and what the faculty in the Senate and the students and so forth have been up to. So some of the highlights of this past year, we've had visits from President Easter, from Trustee Estrada, Vice President Shook, and with the Chancellor's blessing, we co-sponsored with her a visit from former UIUC faculty member and former president of University of Texas Austin, Larry Faulkner, who he was a visit with you last year at your retreat, who talked about the role of faculty in shared governance under challenging economic times for higher education. And that was a very stimulating presentation. So some of the topics that we covered this year, just to spare you the misery of having to read this detailed report, we've talked about MOOCs, we've talked about UI labs, we've talked about diversity and inclusion in Senate activities and across the university. We've talked about safety and security in a university that has an aging, crumbling, and under-repaired infrastructure, and many other issues of importance to the faculty, to the staff, and to the students who we serve on the Senate. And as a reminder to you all, we do this as a volunteer basis. We have our faculty jobs. We have extensive research programs, extensive commitments to education and teaching, and various other activities for our colleges, and so we do this kind of going above and beyond because we believe in UIC. And we want to make a difference to the lives of people at UIC. And I think you've seen making a difference is really important to us. In, for example, Campus Insights, you've seen the research that's done, and you see what a difference that makes, not just at UIC, but in Chicago and indeed across the world with some of the research. And so you know about our research activities. And we're obviously getting recognition for that with increased rankings in the various rankings that are used. But none of that would really matter if we were not educating students. You know, we're not just a research institute, we're an urban university, and we've got a strong commitment, and our faculty here and the Senate believes in this, in the mission of UIC to educate our students that come through the doors here at UIC. And in fact, one of the primary goals of the Senate, according to the statutes by which we operate, is that of academics. You'll notice we have a Senate Committee on Educational Policy, which vets and approves all new and changed academic programs, all the courses a student takes. They all have to be approved by the Senate. And so really, and this was emphasized by Professor Faulkner when he came to talk to us, one of the key roles of the faculty, and indeed the Senate, is as the gatekeeper of the quality of the academic educational programs. And that's something we take very seriously at UIC, and I know that the other campus Senates do as well. So we take great pride in in the education of our students, and we want to make a difference in their lives. Even if a student leaves after one semester because they decide being here is not for them, we hope we can make a difference to them and affect their lives in a positive way. And this is something which I think we take very seriously, particularly given UIC's mission. We're not just an ivory tower. We have a very special role in the city and in the state. So anyway, as we move forward and as you look at dashboards and numbers of graduation, various metrics that you use, remember that they're not just numbers. They are students. We are faculty. We're people. We're doing the best we can given the limited resources we have. We would like to do more to help our students, but you have to help us. One of the things that Professor Faulkner said was that as we are the people that control the education, you have to trust us to do our job to educate the students and give us the resources that we need to do the best job we can. So please engage the faculty here at UIC, at UIS, at UIUC in working with us so that we can serve our students in the best possible way. And with that, thank you, and I'll see you this time next year, probably. Thanks.
Any questions? Okay. All right, the next speaker is no stranger. Dr. Don Chambers, who is professor of the Department of Physiology and Biophysics at Chicago, to report on faculty issues. Don, welcome.
Thank you, sir. It would be remiss of me not to recall that about a year ago, I was standing here giving my final report as chair of the Senate's conference, and you honored me, and that was one of the deciding moments of my life, so thank you. So today I'm here to tell you some of the activities that a subcommittee of the Senate's conference has been dealing with. And this, if you remember, about a year and a half ago when I described the role of the Senate's conference, I said that we had adopted unanimously the responsibility of working for the greater good of the university. In order to do this, under the current leadership of Nick Bourboulis, we broke ourselves down into four subcommittees that map on to the board subcommittee. And I chair the subcommittee on health affairs and the hospital. So today I'm going to talk to you about academic medical centers and the University of Illinois, sort of as possibly in preparation for the retreat in July. And on the left, you see our medical center, the University of Illinois Medical Center at Chicago. And on the right, you see perhaps what I would argue is the gold standard for academic medical centers, the Massachusetts General Hospital. And this is the 2011 was the bicentennial year of the MGH, which started in this building called the Bullfinch Building. And Dr. Koritz will remember, although he wasn't there at the time, that the first ether operation was done in that building. And Dr. Koritz spent some time in that building, right? So, and the Ether Dome is still a amphitheater that is used now. So this subcommittee consists of Gayula Gabori, Kim Graber, Leslie Struble, and Jorge Villegas. And we met initially, and we said collectively, there is an issue. And that issue was that the UIC Medical School is ranked 62nd by US News and World Report. I will say right now that's a distorted ranking, but nevertheless we wanted to understand why it is ranked that way. And the UIC Hospital is ranked 23rd in the state of Illinois by US News and World Report. And the major questions that we asked are these rankings appropriate and how can they be improved? So what I'm going to deal with today are basically four issues: the nature of academic medical centers, the historic challenges faced by the University of Illinois Medical Center, institutional memory to be precise, our view of the present and potential future, and what can we conclude at this time. I think I really need to tell you this is a work in progress. We have interviewed President Easter. We've interviewed Vice President Garcia. We've interviewed the Dean of the College of Medicine, Dimitri Azar. We've interviewed the Dean of the College of Dentistry, Bruce Graham. And we've interviewed the Dean of the College of Pharmacy, Jerry Bowden. And we're not finished. But this is a summary report for now. Now, in fact, academic medical centers and teaching hospitals function to educate medical students, other health professionals, and provide postgraduate training, usually within the context of a university. The academic clinical faculty, or hospital, essentially has two major functions: to supply the clinical needs for education and to supply the clinical needs for academic clinical research. Now, I have been known to give book, give reading assignment, particularly to Trustee Strobel, who still owes me one. So, as a book report. But I have a deal for you. If you read any of the four books that I'm about to mention, you don't have to give the book report to the previous book. So, a book that you might find very helpful is a book by Ken Ludmerer called Time to Heal. It is the history of American medical education from the turn of the century to the era of managed care, and it also documents very nicely the history of the academic medicine. Now, in 1910, Abraham Flexner was commissioned by the Carnegie Foundation to do a report on the status and nature of medical education in America. And by America, in this case, I mean the United States and Canada. And as a result of that report, 40% of medical schools closed. But what that report did do was it established the university as the natural home for medical education and laid the groundwork for the modern academic medical center. It dichotomized medical education into basic science and clinical education. It developed the concepts of ward rounds, attending physicians, internships, and residencies, and established the concept of the full-time academic salary physician. And the gold standard for that report was the Johns Hopkins Medical School and Hospital, which interestingly enough opened in 1893, but at the time of its opening, it was already the gold standard. In honor of the 100th anniversary of the Flexner Report, I edited and wrote in a volume called Flexner the 100 for Perspectives in Biology and Medicine. So what are the general characteristics of successful academic medical centers? There are many more than four, but these four stand out. It's the pursuit of excellence in all of its dimensions. Sustained leadership, flexibility and adaptability, and pride of community and engagement of faculty. So we can begin to ask in these terms, how do medical centers stand up? So two more books. The Bicentennial History of the Mass General came out in 2011. And I've been giving some of these books to people. What this book really shows is what sustained leadership can do and can do to maintain the academic medical center. And in fact, this year, U.S. News and World Report said the best hospital in the United States and America was the MGH and possibly the world. Another book of great interest is the challenges, how you meet the challenges of the academic medical center as they go, as the world changes. And this is a book by John Kastor called Merging of Teaching Hospitals in Boston, New York, and Northern California. Interestingly enough, I will show you in a minute some dashboard figures of how the Boston hospitals and the Harvard Medical School stand up in the world. But they were concerned that in the era of managed care and so forth, they might not be competitive. That led to a merger of the Brigham and Women's Hospital and the Massachusetts General Hospital and the Dana-Farber Cancer Center. In New York, a similar thing happened. And the Presbyterian Hospital, which was the main teaching hospital for Columbia, and the New York Hospital, which was the main teaching hospital for Cornell, merged while keeping the medical schools separate. So you can see here two different models. A model where there are two medical schools feeding into a merged hospital, and there is a merger of two hospitals feeding into one medical school. Now, in fact, in both cases,
the medical schools, unlike the University of Illinois, do not own their hospitals. So now let me turn for a minute, or for a couple of minutes, to the historic challenges that were faced by the University of Illinois Medical Center. The first challenge was a drug called Grabiazin, and I will detail this in a little while. But Grabiazin was a fraudulent cancer drug, and that was promulgated by Andrew Ivey, who was our vice chancellor of the then University of Illinois Medical Campus, and that led to the formation of the School of Basic Medical Sciences and the Abraham Lincoln School of Medicine, which separated clinical medicine from basic science, an absolute disaster in the terms of translational research. And that separation did not become rejoined until 1982 as a direct function of the formation of the University of Illinois at Chicago. The second challenge or impediment was the loss of the Rush Medical School faculty who were once part of the University of Illinois. The third was an issue of closing our hospital and affiliating with Michael Reese. The fourth were IRB difficulties with the NIH, and the fifth you heard about this morning, the continuing problems of the hospital. So let's talk about the first challenge, Grabiazin. Grabiazin was touted as a miracle drug for cancer treatment. It was actually found to be creatinine, a metabolic product of protein metabolism and of muscle metabolism. And in fact, it had absolutely no effect on cancer. However, Andrew Ivey, the chancellor of the medical center, actually was indicted at the time that he was tried. He lied under oath. And the lie was that he said that there were 14 patients in a clinical trial, and as he was testifying, 10 of them had gotten better. In fact, I'm sorry, 14 of them had gotten better. In fact, 10 of them had died. So he was dismissed. But that led to essentially the discrediting of basic sciences by the clinicians. And they essentially dissociated and formed the School of Basic Medical Sciences and the Abraham Lincoln School of Medicine. Second challenge, Rush Medical School has a very long distinguished history, beginning in 1833. In fact, the first diagnosis of a heart attack was done by James Herrick, a Rush physician in the early part of the 20th century, and he also is responsible for discovering sickle cell anemia. At any rate, after a long distinguished history, in 1942, Rush Medical School closed its doors, but maintained the teaching hospitals of Presbyterian and St. Luke's Hospital. And the faculty became faculty members of the University of Illinois. And by the affiliation agreement said that 20 years later, they would reevaluate. In the succeeding 20 years, we managed to have one of our senior administrators, who was the vice chancellor, not Ivy, but the person who succeeded him, the vice chancellor for the medical campus, got into a virility contest with the leader of Rush and basically said, if you don't like it, the hell with you. And he said, okay, we'll start our own medical school. And the affiliation was dissolved, and the Rush Medical School charter was reactivated, and that led to the reestablishment of the Rush College of Medicine and essentially the structures that are down the street from us. Then there was another challenge. The University of Illinois Hospital opened in 1982. I was here at the time to great celebration. And it opened initially as a 600-bed teaching hospital. Within a year, it was apparent that we were losing money hand over fist. We had problems with so-called payer mix, and the hospital was downsized to about 450. And the financial difficulties continued. In 1989, the dean of the College of Medicine, Phil Foreman, negotiated an affiliation agreement with Michael Reese in comparative privacy to be the primary teaching hospital for the University of Illinois at Chicago. Cook County was to be given UI. And that led to a huge amount of faculty political action that defeated the plan. Phil Foreman resigned as dean, and within 1 year, 15 clinical department heads were replaced by their cognate department heads at Reese. That changed the profile and nature of the clinical operation once again. And here is an article from the Chicago Tribune from December of 1988 describing the fact that we wanted to go out of the hospital business by merging with Michael Reese. Now we move to 1999, and we had a whistleblower who argued that we had a whistleblower who argued that we weren't obeying IRB rules, and our provost said, well, bring on the NIH, we can defend ourselves. This is like saying to the IRS, come and do an audit. And in fact, the NIH did an investigation and closed us down. And David Broski resigned and was replaced by Sylvia Mann. There's one other point that I haven't mentioned, and that is that we then ultimately had a structure of a vice president for health affairs, Chip Rice, who has gone on to be the dean of the Uniform University Medical School, and Jerry Moss was dean of the College of Medicine. They couldn't get along with one another. They had a disastrous life. And Chancellor Manning fired both of them, and a year later she resigned. So this doesn't represent great amounts of sustained leadership. So is there any good news? And yes, there is good news. NIH funding has remained relatively strong and has the potential for continued improvement. Now if you look at another ranking system, and that is the NIH funding ranking system, we're in the 40s. And I'm going to review this ranking system for you in a moment, because it speaks to a message that I gave to this group about a year ago when we were talking about dashboards, and I said, you know, on every dashboard now there's a tachometer. How many people really understand what a tachometer does? The take-home message from that is you have to interpret even a dashboard. So here are the top NIH grant funding by institutions in 2010. And by the way, I just looked at the 2011 figures. They are about the same, but actually slightly lower. So the top institution has somewhat less money, and that's probably a problem of the vicissitudes of the NIH. At any rate, on both lists, Johns Hopkins is number one, University of Pennsylvania is number two, University of Washington is three, Michigan is four. I've put some points to look at. Mass General is 13th. So you see a steady progression from close to 700,000. You're doing well, you're in the top 10, basically, if you're above 400 million. And then you go down to the 300 million level. But I want you to notice something. The Mass General is at 382 million. The Brigham is at 355 million. If you look at the Harvard University Medical School, it's at 255 million. So, and I'll show you a couple more. The Dana-Farber Cancer Center is right below us. The sum and substance is, if we take all of the Harvard-associated hospitals and combine it with the funding that the Harvard Medical School has, the total funding for the Harvard operation is $1.6 billion, dwarfing everything else. So you have to be very careful in how you define these numbers. So where are we? So we are 45. But now understand, we're not really 45 because we've got four Harvard Place centers in front of us. So we're really 41. Now, say something else. Let us talk about the way you count. Many of these institutions count their total NIH funding. And if we did this, we would have to add the funding of Urbana, of the Urbana campus, which is $73 million. And if we want to talk about the Illinois Medical District, we include Rush, that's got $37 million. If just by accounting purposes, we fold those in, we go back, and we are at this number. So we're pretty close to 20, just by what I call a proper interpretation. So that's very, very good news from my point of view. The second part of the good news is that the revitalization of the Illinois Medical District under the leadership of Warren Ripley and Jennifer Woodard, now gives us new opportunities for synergies and productive affiliations. And it also allows us to bring things like the Blue Water supercomputer company and another company that deals with clinical productivity into the fold. And if we increase our problem, we have the largest amount of funding for basic science in the state of Illinois. It's the clinical funding that has fallen down, and you can see why. The reasons are quite apparent. It's because of the problems we have had with our clinical operation that Skip mentioned actually this morning. So what can we conclude from this? One, the challenges faced by academic medical centers, including the University of Illinois Medical Center, relate to the integration of structure, function, and personality, as well as enunciation of vision, consistent leadership, and the absence of bold, innovative thinking coupled with risk aversion. So what that really says is that these challenges are multifactorial. They're not just structure, they're not just function, they are a continuum of all of these things. So what do we say? All of these problems are solvable, provided we can maintain strong leadership, which we really haven't had over a 30-year period. And that leadership is coupled to willing and talented faculty who will develop a pride and sense of ownership and of community. The good news, the very good news, is that the basis for strong scientific research has been maintained, but the integration of basic research